Okay, slides are visible, everybody can see that? Good, good. All right, so, nothing unusual here, this is just the title slide. But again, this is a set of lectures that I've prepared. I think there's a total of five of them over the course of the semester, which will substitute for the textbook that we don't actually have. The textbook that, for various kinds of sociological reasons having to do with the structure of methodological inquiry within the social sciences, people don't tend to write. People don't write books of multiple independent kinds of qualitative research methodology. People either write quantitative methodology books, or they write qualitative methodology books that reduce everything to the lowest common denominator. And what I'm going to do in the course of this course, that was really awkward, during the semester, what we're going to do is we're going to look at these three things, three different kinds of non-quantitative work, and we're going to look at them all independently and try to get at what the assumptions that drive each of them are. So that's kind of our basic modus operandi. So what I would like you to do to start out with, though, is I would like you to take a piece of paper, and I would like you to answer the following very easy question. I would like you to write down three things that you know. Quickly. I know you all know three things, you're graduate students. You must know at least three things. Of course, it's funny because you ask this question of philosophy undergrads and they all scratch their heads and like, I don't know if I know anything. All right, so after you've got your three things that you know, then what I would like you to do is I'd like you to choose one of those things. And I would like you to think for a moment about how you know it. How you know that thing that you have just claimed to know. Right? How do you know that this is in fact the case? How do you know that this is in some sense true? It's a slightly harder question. And now that you have a handle on that, what I'd like you to do is I'd like you to think for a moment about how you would convince somebody else of this thing that you know. How would you convince somebody else who didn't already agree with this thing that you think that you know? How would you demonstrate to someone else that you were actually correct and that their contrary point of view was somehow inaccurate or incomplete or misleading or, you know, just flat out wrong? All right, so somebody want to volunteer? What do you know and how do you know it? Or do I just start volunteering people? John. But just because of the John Jonathan discussion, I was like, okay, so I could get your name off of that. So.
Well, first thing that came to my mind is, again, given the context, I'm a student at AU.
Okay.
I
know I'm a student at AU. I'm just repeating this for the sake of the podcast.
And I explained it as in because I'm here right now with everybody else in a learning environment at American University, the institution on Mass Ave, in a class. And how to convince it to somebody else that wasn't here and wasn't sure of it, I guess through legal documentation or student ID.
All right, so you know you're here, and that's interesting because you have two different, the way you're sure of it is not through legal documentation, you're sure of it through personal experience, but the way you would demonstrate it to somebody else involves not personal experience, but demonstrating with some sort of a document or
to somebody else that wasn't here.
To someone else who wasn't actually here. To someone who was here, how would you do it?
Through personal experience, through interaction with them.
So if they're actually here, then you can take them around and, you know, demonstrate that you're actually part of the enrollment system and
right. People
don't bar you from getting into buildings. Trying to explain student status to someone would be kind of interesting. Though, of course, if you were to do it, you would presumably, since we're still talking about experience, you'd have broader experiences of studentness and the concept of the university to draw on, so you could perhaps sort of explain it to them that way. But again, we've got two different kinds of standards for evidence here. We've got authority-based, it says so in some document. And we've got experience, I can observe it, I can in some sense touch it. Though you can't really I mean, you can't really touch studentness, but you can certainly demonstrate it, right? You can show that it is instantiated in practice. I can pull up a roster, though again, that blurs the lines because the roster is an official document, right? But we've got these two different kinds of standards. All right, other thoughts, other things that people know?
Well, since we didn't talk very much about things, I know that I love my kids more than anyone else.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I could give proof of that. Mm. Unless in very strange circumstances, I don't think that I can give proof of that.
Mm-hmm.
And about convincing someone, again, it goes to the second answer, but still I could make the argument that I do for them things that I never thought I'd do before I had them.
Mm.
So kind of, I wouldn't call them sacrifices and such, but I would give up easily things that in the past, before I had them, I never thought that I would.
All right, so something that you know.
Examples,
mm-hmm. There could be evidence that would demonstrate that you love your kids, but under normal circumstances, this wouldn't even be a question. So under normal circumstances, this is, if I heard you right, an appeal to what we might call common knowledge. Something that we know. We know that parents love their kids. That's sort of an established thing that we have floating around. And so under normal circumstances, it would be as silly to try to demonstrate that as me demonstrating to you that this is my left hand. It's just kind of obvious. I don't have to prove to you that this is my arm, right? Because how many of you don't think this is my arm, right? See, Wittgenstein once wrote a whole book about this. Based on this marvelous thing where somebody to try to prove that there was an external world by saying, first I see one hand, and then I see another hand. Therefore, there's an external world. Next. And Wittgenstein said, that's really fascinating, because what that does, it doesn't actually prove anything. What it does is it proves that it's commonly accepted that there's an external world, because no one thinks to question it. You know, Wittgenstein you talk about this sort of being unusual circumstances where you'd have to demonstrate that you love your kids. Wittgenstein said, under what circumstances would it make sense for someone to say, I have a hand? Well, if you were a combat veteran and you were just waking up out of a coma, you might use the sentence, oh, I have a hand. And this would actually be something that would be sort of striking, because maybe you weren't sure that you still had your hand after what you'd been through. But it would be an unusual story. In normal everyday life, it's something that we appeal to common knowledge. We don't even normally think about it as kind of an empirical proposition that we have to go out and test. Right? So there's something kind of odd about thinking about trying to validate that. So we've got a different set of knowledge criteria here. Other thoughts? Let me get one more.
I just looked at my water bottle and I said, I know that Coca-Cola owns Dasani.
Okay. That's a good one. Coca-Cola owns Dasani.
Because it says on the label and because people told me. And how would I prove it to somebody else? I'd show them the label and then I'd probably Google it and sign on their mind.
All right, so we can demonstrate that Coke owns Dasani. And it's interesting, because if you try to say in certain contexts that Coke owns Dasani, you're probably going to be met with disbelief. Not here. People at AU probably, because of AU's kind of leanings, know these things. But in other circumstances, oh, no. Try speaking to, how stereotypical can I be here? We all have a certain number of elderly relatives who are not particularly critical about the world. And so if you try to explain things to them like, but Walmart is evil, then they don't really sort of, no, it's just a store and it's cheap. And they don't really think about the sort of broader political, economic things that it's entrenched in. So claims like that might be difficult in certain circumstances. But then showing that, so the label kind of counts as an authoritative document in some way. But of course, then, and this is another generational thing, the real authority is if we Google it. You know, because if it's on Google, then clearly. If Google can find millions of hits about it. Not Wikipedia, interestingly. We're all graduate students. If you're undergrad, you'd say Wikipedia. Grad students know a little better than that. We don't go with Wikipedia. We go with other things you can find Googling online, like that which I'm sure we've all seen, the little Flash movie animation that somebody did of how all the health food companies are owned by all of these large mega food conglomerates. If you go on YouTube, you can find it. There's this little Flash movie that starts off with all these little health food things, and then it sort of shows the little dots being gobbled up by these big mega conglomerations, and you discover that kind of tracing right there, that Dasani is owned by Coke, and various other sorts of health food products are owned by these large agricultural businesses. So that exists, and that's pretty good proof for a lot of people, right, to be able to have something like that. So again, back between that sort of authoritative document version and personal experience on the other. So we've got a fair number of different ways of thinking about how we know things. And the reason I want to start off at that rather abstract level is because whatever else we're doing when we do research is we're trying to make and validate claims to know something. So we have to have some good handle at first on what it means to know stuff. Let me pull out a couple things systematically from both what we've said and, interestingly, what we haven't said. So, different ways of knowing. There's one way of knowing that we didn't talk much about here, though we got closest to it with the example of the loving of one's children, which is the idea of things you know innately. Things you know kind of internally to the point where you don't really question them. For many religious believers, this is where knowledge of God would be placed. Not an empirical proposition, not something one verifies or validates or even tests, but instead something that one knows kind of intrinsically or innately. Now, it's hard to distinguish something you know innately from a mere assertion, because, of course, if you know it innately, then it's not like you appeal to external authorities in order to validate it. So it's not like you can point to something. You can just say, I know it. I feel it. I think, again, of the example of whether one loves one's children. You can point to things, but there's something kind of artificial about that. But that's about all we have, and we have something that we kind of know that intrinsically. This is one of the things that makes innate knowing difficult or perhaps impossible to communicate to other people. It's very difficult to communicate my personal transcendental experience of the oneness of the universe to you, because if I attempt to do that, then it starts to sound like most mystical language sounds, which is to say, very odd, unless you've had a similar kind of experience already, right? So this is one problem, and you're dual majoring over at Wesley, is one thing one always runs into with certain kinds of experiential theological language, that there are ways in which discussions of faith, discussions of God, regardless of which God and which faith we're talking about, run into this problem of not being communicable at some level. This is a problem that Ludwig Wittgenstein, a philosopher of whom I am quite, perhaps inordinately fond, and will therefore bring up from time to time, called the private language problem, which is if you have a thought and you can put it into words, then you have stopped it from being purely private. You have translated it into some sort of terminology that is expressible to other people. In so doing, you have taken and in many ways compromised the private character of that particular experience by externalizing it so other people now have access to it. And there's a way in which if you are talking about something that's truly something you know innately, any verbal or linguistic formulation of it is going to feel inadequate, right? So proofs of the love of one's children. Okay, sure, but there's something that's sort of left behind there that's very, very difficult to actually communicate. Now, fortunately, empirical research doesn't actually deal with things one knows innately. In fact, things that one knows innately are kind of off the table as far as empirical research is concerned. There is no amount of evidence that one can present to a religious believer that God does not exist. Similarly, there is no amount of evidence one can produce to an atheist believer that God does exist. These are interpretive frames for understanding the world. They are not facts about the world. It is therefore not possible to prove or disprove them. Fortunately, this is not a sphere we actually have to deal with in a class on empirical research. This is what they deal with in the seminary. This is what they deal with over in the Spiritual Life Center. This is what they deal with in other areas. Even when we do research on things like religion, things like theology, we will not, by virtue of the fact that we're doing empirical research here, be interested in the private experience of those things. We're interested in their public articulation, in the way that they play out, in the effect that they have. And effects, we can see. Behaviors, we can see. Interpretations, public documents, those are things we can see. Innate knowing, not something we can see, and also not something that's really applicable to this kind of empirical methodology. So we're now researching that stuff, and that's good, because we're not telepathic, so we can't have direct access to one another's innermost thoughts, and wouldn't that be scary if we could? So let's just move on and talk a little bit about another way of knowing, which is a way of knowing what we might call deductive knowing. Knowing something is true deductively. This basically means that we reason from axioms through to conclusions. This is the sort of knowing that you find particularly in fields like mathematics, right? The idea, we give you a simple sort of mathematical proposition, right? The sum of all angles of a triangle is 180 degrees. Right? Well, that is a mathematical proposition, and it is true beyond a reasonable doubt, given certain definitions of angle and degree and triangle. You take the axioms, you put them together, you use certain well-established logical rules to combine them, and you come up with something that is necessarily, absolutely, categorically, completely true within its particular limited sphere. All right? Deductive knowing gives you absolute certainty. If the premises are true, the conclusion must be true. No ifs, no ands, no buts, nothing else. Right? That is one thing that's very appealing about deductive knowing, that it can be absolutely certain. And it is important that we realize that the absolute certainty in question relies on all the premises being true. The famous thing about triangles being, you know, the sum of all the angles of a triangle adding up to 180 degrees actually has what geometers like to refer to as a hidden premise attached to it, which is the premise that the triangle you're talking about exists on a flat plane. If the triangle no longer exists on a flat plane, if it exists on, say, a curved surface, say if it's a triangle drawn on the surface of the Earth, large sort of latitudinal triangle, the angles start adding up to other things. In fact, the angles often add up to 360, which is impossible to draw on a two-dimensional planar surface, but very easy to draw on a curved surface. If you assume that the angles of a navigational triangle actually added up to 180 degrees, you would end up in pretty much the wrong place if you were trying to, say, run a satellite around the planet. There are ways in which all of the assumptions have to be spelled out in order for things to be absolutely logically true. So we always have to be very careful when we're doing that kind of work. It is, however, the only correct use of the word proof. We often use the word proof loosely. We talk about proof as simply being, adducing evidence in support of a position. That's not actually proof. That's called argument. Argument is very useful, very important. It's what we spend most of our time doing. It is not, however, proof. Proof, technically speaking, requires this kind of absolute deductive logic. Now, one thing that's very interesting about proof and deductive logic is that these are not empirical claims. What makes a statement about a triangle's angles true has nothing to do with any actual observed triangle in the world. It has to do with certain mathematical principles about the way angles work in imaginary spaces. Empirical research on triangles cannot tell you very much about absolute mathematical truth. Empirical research about parallel lines cannot tell you very much about absolute mathematical truth of various kinds of propositions. This is why mathematicians are not renowned for their empirical research skills. That's not what they do. Mathematicians reason about things. If there are people who go out there and actually apply math to the world, they are not mathematicians anymore. They are called engineers. This is different. Right? Once you start bringing the empirical world into things, one of the things that philosophers of science realized a long, long time ago, that as soon as you start bringing messy empirical facts into your claims about things, it is almost impossible to stick with purely deductive truth. And you have to start invoking different kinds of standards of evidence and different standards of validity. What that means, of course, is that nothing that we research in our domain, world politics, can be said to be proven, because we don't have absolute logical certainty about any of this stuff, because it involves A, empirical phenomena, and B, these inordinately messy creatures called humans that have this weird habit of doing things like perversely that don't actually line up with what they're deductively supposed to do. And they also have this odd habit of like reading the predictions that you made about what they're supposed to do and then saying, just to screw you up, I'm just going to go in the opposite direction, because why not? And this has been made even worse by the internet, where all of a sudden you can have results being reported instantaneously. A few years ago, a number of sociologists talked about what they called the instant sociology of everything, the idea that it was becoming so quick to actually produce sociological commentaries about things that then the people in question would read them and start changing things around. And the problem is they were several years ahead of their time. Now we actually do have the instant sociology and instant international relations and instant political theory and whatever of everything, because as soon as it's done, it's either published and therefore publicly accessible on the internet, or it's blogged and even more publicly accessible because then you get it through your feeds and whatever. And if you watch how sort of memes transfer through the blogosphere, you watch sort of a notion show up on a blog and then somebody links to it and somebody else links to it and boom, 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 and things are all over the place. So clearly we have contamination effects going on here. So abandon for the next 7 weeks the idea that you're ever actually going to prove anything. You're not. You're not going to have absolute deductive logical certainty. Not here. That's not what we do. Fortunately, it's not what empirical research is about anyway. Empirical research, it turns out, is about knowing things experientially, about having something in the world that you can point to and then drawing conclusions from that experience that are more or less valid. By experientially, I mean that the kind of knowing that we are interested in the social sciences involves some kind of reference to empirical evidence, whether that is evidence of your own personal experience, evidence of somebody else's experience, the observable evidence of a publicly held document, something like that. There's some tangible thing that can be pointed to. When you're dealing with experiential, broadly experiential ways of knowing, claims that we make require public support. They have to be substantiated. Not the case with innate knowing. I don't have to support my claims. I just have to know it, and maybe know it a lot. And deduction, I don't have to provide evidence to support it. I have to provide you with a logical chain in order to reason up to it. When you're dealing with a claim that is known experientially, there has to be evidence. There has to be some way to substantiate that claim. This also means that experiential knowing is the kind of thing you can communicate a little bit more easily, at least in practice, because you've got valid grounds on which to place the claim, which are public. They're out there. They're actually observable. Experiential knowing is not arbitrary. You can't just make stuff up, but it is never absolutely certain in the way that deductive mathematical proof would be absolutely certain. Even the best social scientific findings are contestable and continue to be contested. One of my favorite examples of this is this notion that democratic regimes don't go to war with each other, which every time people mention, you have to think of with a little asterisk in your mind. The asterisk is, given certain definitions of democracy, war, go-to, regime, and a time period. So once you get all that stuff agreed on, then yeah, okay, maybe the proposition works, sort of. It's a very, very tricky thing. The point is that everybody involved in that debate, though, is pointing to a set of experiential objects. No one is saying, democracies don't go to war with each other and I just know it. They would not be able to publish particularly well. They would, however, be able to run for public office, which is very interesting because politicians have very different evidentiary standards than we do. They are able to get away with innate knowledge in ways that responsible social researchers are not. They can stand up and make claims about things. One of my favorites in recent memory was, I know he's a good person. I looked into his soul. That's a doubly interesting consideration. One, because it's innate knowledge, and secondly, because it's not only is it innate knowledge, but it's innate knowledge of something that by definition isn't empirically perceivable. So it's like, whoa, we're in a whole different place here now. That's not what we call, and I'll introduce some of the technical language for it next week, it's not what we would call a falsifiable proposition. It's not something you can test against anything. It is a piece of innate knowledge. And what was fascinating to watch when the president made that claim was how much of the country actually rallied to that and said, yeah, yeah, okay. Souls, we buy that. Looking into people's souls, yeah, okay, that's cool. We're all about that. What this demonstrates, of course, is that the electorate are not, it's not that the electorate are bad social scientists. The electorate actually aren't social scientists. That's not what they do. That's not the way ordinary sort of, you know, a lot of the sort of sense-making that gets done in politics. It's a very different mode of inquiry than the stuff we're going to be talking about here. Whether or not the ordinary mode of sense-making that a lot of people operate with is better or worse than this one is a question that I'm going to defer until the end of the course. But this is what we're going to be mostly dealing with, not questions of whether people have good souls. All empirical research is experiential in one way or another. All claims that we make within the social sciences, at some level, they go back to experience. Now, there are a set of philosophical debates that I am not going to get into much here during this semester about whether or not all of the things you use to explain the empirical world have to themselves be empirical. This is a debate that philosophers of physics get stuck in all the time. It's a question of whether quarks and gluons really exist, because quarks and gluons, see, are theoretically imperceivable. You can't see them. Dark matter is another good one. Right? Definition of dark matter is matter that you can't detect. Okay, so there's something you can't detect, there's something you can't perceive, but somehow it's still real. This is a question that astronomers get stuck in all the time. Philosophers of physics, philosophers of astronomy get stuck in all the time. Fortunately, none of us are doing work on that, so we don't necessarily have to get too far into that particular controversy. There's one area where we may have to touch on it a little bit, which is the question of something that you see tossed around an awful lot in the social sciences, which is this notion of social structure. We talk about there being such things as structures, yet you cannot drop them on your foot. So there's something kind of odd going on with what it means to have a structure. But that's something we will come back to a little bit. I don't want to go into it in inordinate detail. Suffice for right now to realize that even when people bring up things that may or may not empirically exist or may not be perceivable, what they're doing is they're trying to use them to explain stuff that is actually perceivable. Think about the notion of social structure. We invoke it when we want to explain stuff like, why are these people revolting? Or why that didn't sound good. Why are these people rising up in arms against other people? Why are these military individuals sort of repressing these folks, right? When we're trying to explain something that's sort of perceivable. Why is the government of Burma not allowing foreign aid to come into its country to minister to the estimated 100,000 people who were killed and all of the various sorts of survivors that are still floating around in the wake of that, right? We talk about these things like social structures. But we're still trying to explain a very concrete observable thing, which is aid not getting into the country that we can actually look at and touch and feel, right? So there's a reference back to this kind of experiential thing. I sound like I'm belaboring this point. I'm belaboring this point because you'll see as we go through this, it gets a little tricky in places. So, but I want to make sure we're all on the same page to start out with. So you put this stuff together. And what then is the goal of this kind of experiential, empirical social research that we are doing? Well, I said, and I use this formulation on the syllabus as well, I think that in many ways what we do when we are doing empirical research is about transforming data, simple observations, into facts. Right? Facts are not out there in the world. Data is out there in the world. Stuff is out there in the world. Facts are what happen when you take the data and organize it in particular ways. Filter it through what we talked about earlier, a set of contexts. So then we end up with facts. When we did our little interview exercise earlier in the class, we all generated facts about one another's lives. We took data, simple bits of information, and we put it together. In particular, what we did is we put it together to form some sort of coherent story that would make sense in a social context. What we were doing is taking data and bringing it in. Right? David Easton, a great sort of political theorist and thinker about these things a number of years ago, once argued that a fact, I love this phrase, a fact is a particular ordering of reality in terms of a theoretical interest. Right? So think about that. Right? A fact doesn't just exist out there. There's a theoretical contextual element to what we think of as the facts. And what you do when you do research is you build facts, because data is just information. Data is just stuff. It's just kind of out there. And if you've taken SIS 600 or if you've done quantitative work, you know this very, very well. Right? The raw data that you work with is just a bunch of numbers arranged in rows and columns. There you go. That's just data. Those aren't facts yet. It doesn't become facts until you do something with it and actually put it together in some way. Take those observations, figure out what matters and what doesn't, and then assemble them in order to make some kind of a coherent point or argument out of it. So you might say a fact is a piece of data or sets of data which has been placed into an appropriate context. Now, what research does is research accomplishes this task via methodology. That's what methodology is all about, translating data into facts. This is, as I said earlier, a more explicit form of what people generally do all the time anyway. People are always taking data and translating them into facts. My example earlier of innate knowledge about the state of people's souls is in fact a methodology. It's just not an empirical research methodology. It is a way of translating data into facts. It's just not the sort of thing that would sort of pass muster in terms of peer-reviewed publications and things like that. Research that, in general, what people do is we take data, we take stuff we observe, and we translate it into facts by putting it in some sort of appropriate context. Karl Popper, who's a philosopher of science that we'll have occasion to reference a little bit later on, once pointed out that knowledge production and research and methodology is just what humans do We spin knowledge the way spiders spin webs. We just do it. By living in the world, you produce knowledge. You do that. You've been doing it since you were born. This is like that thing with that famous Molière line where suddenly the guy wakes up and realizes he's been speaking prose all his life. You've been producing facts all your life. You have. All we're going to do in this class is we're going to make that more explicit, how it is you've been doing that. And we're going to start critically examining what some of those assumptions are like. So.
If I understand facts are not objective elements, they are not there.
I think it's problematic to say that there are the sort of facts are just kind of out there, because any ordering of reality is going to have a certain kind of theoretical perspective associated with it. And the question truth I'll get to in a second, because you can still have isn't that a pretentious statement? Truth, we'll get to that on the next slide, or two slides down, right? No, in fact, if we go back to what I was talking about before with the difference between deductive research and empirical research. In many ways, I don't know that when we're doing empirical research, we get truth. We get well-validated arguments. We get facts. We get claims that stand up and can be verified. But in terms of truth, especially usually when we use a word like truth, we mean something big and weighty, right? God, life after death, moral questions. It's hard to decide a moral question with empirical research. Right? How much empirical research can show you whether some particular elimination of one population by another was premeditated, but it can't tell you that premeditated elimination of another population is wrong. The second category is something that stands outside of empirical research. Personally, when I tend to talk about this stuff, I like to reserve the word truth for those sort of questions, and when we're dealing with empirical research, I prefer to talk about things like validity or coherence or appropriate context, as we'll see. Again, this doesn't mean you make stuff up, right? Facts are not stuff you kind of imagine. You still use, if you're doing it right, you still use pieces of empirical data, and you just put these things together in various ways. And what we're going to be examining is ways in which that happens. So, and we're not going to solve any of these questions tonight. I'm just tossing a bunch of stuff out. Let me talk a little bit about theory, because I've mentioned it and said that facts are inevitably theoretical or perspectival in some way, right? All empirical research is in some sense theoretical. There's a point of view built into any kind of empirical research claim. Even if we're not really that explicit about what that claim actually is, it's always there. There's always some set of contexts that are informing these things. So in some sense, really describing the facts actually means relating the facts from a certain point of view. If I tell you what the facts are about some situation, then what I've actually done, of course, is I've taken my perspective and I've organized the data according to it. We all know this because we all watch. We all can see politicians doing this. We see newspapers doing this. We see other academics doing this. We do this ourselves, right? How many times have you been in an argument and you realize that what's actually going on in the argument is just, it's not that you disagree about the evidence, you just disagree about what it means. And you disagree about what the conclusions are you ought to be drawing from this, right? So there's always a set of perspectives that are encoded in here. And in some ways, what methodology allows us to do is to make that explicit so we can start seeing what those perspectives actually are. Methodological reflection, which is what we're going to do a lot of here, is about making your point of view explicit. And making your point of view explicit so we can talk about it sort of openly, but also so that when you are doing research yourself, you can adhere to it consistently. Or perhaps realize that the point of view you thought you were adhering to is actually not one you actually want to adhere to, in which case, well, it's time to change, which you can do because we've got three different things on the menu, so there's no need to necessarily go with one or the other until we get to the end of the course. And in fact, you notice since there's no final exam, I'm not ever going to actually make you make a choice between these three. I'm just going to say, here's one, here's two, here's three, and then the course ends. And I will talk on the last day about, again, what do we do next, but at no point during the class am I going to sort of force you into sort of adhering to any of these. That being said, I'm going to make you temporarily put on each of these three hats so you can sort of look at the world from each of these three kinds of points of view. And that's basically what this is about. This gentleman is Max Weber. This is the young Max. This is kind of like Elvis. You get the young Elvis and the old Elvis. This is the young Max. And I put up Max Weber because, well, I have this Weber thing. I enjoy Weber a lot. He's someone I go back to a lot for thinking about the social sciences. And I put up the young Max because when Weber was young, not quite this young, but Jung, he wrote a brilliant methodological piece that was a piece called The Objectivity of Social Scientific and Sociopolitical Knowledge. 1905 he wrote this. And he argued in that piece that different methodological assumptions are what produce different kinds of facts out of similar data. And his example was economic historians looking back at medieval Europe. And he said, if you have different economic assumptions, if you're a Marxist and you look back at medieval Europe, what are you going to see? Well, you're going to see embryonic class relations, and you're going to see exploitation, and you're going to see appropriation of surplus. Now, if you're not, if you're actually a market-based economist and you look back, what are you going to see? You're going to see imperfect labor markets. And you're going to see contracting that's not explicit, so there's a lot of appropriation of surpluses. You're going to see coercion that's actually interfering with the proper operation of supply-demand mechanisms. Who's right? That's a hard question, because we're not in the realm of evidence. We're in the realm of facts. We're in the realm of theoretical slants on particular pieces of data. So Weber said the solution to this is to realize that all of the knowledge that we have is what he called ideal typical. It all comes from a particular way of thinking about the world, or particular ways of thinking about the world. And therefore, knowledge is always relative to some kind of orientation, some sort of value orientation, which is one of the things that gets embedded in these different kinds of research methodologies, a certain kind of value orientation. A lot of the questions, the big questions that are lurking behind these kinds of decisions about what kind of research to do and how to do it, turn out to be these very, very profound and irresolvable philosophical and moral issues about what it means to be a human being, what society is, what it means to know things. Right? There's a huge number of these sort of philosophical issues. And you can't actually not look at that stuff. It's a mistake to just kind of jump in and actually just start doing your research. It's important to kind of linger at the beginning of any research project in precisely this area. So we will for a few minutes. I said there was a truth slide. I misestimated. I thought it was the next slide. It was actually three or four slides further on. But anyway, I knew there was a truth slide in here someplace. Because empirical research, I don't think, is about truth with a big capital T. Empirical research, I think, is about facts and true statements defined as those that express the facts. Right? So we use true with a lowercase t sometimes to designate that. Usually to avoid confusion, I usually won't talk about truth when I'm sort of operating in the realm of empirics and facts. I'll usually talk about other things, but I'll use other kinds of terminology. But if you do, you know, I think that's an important distinction. And it's a distinction I cribbed from that marvelous, marvelous American pragmatist philosopher, Indiana Jones, from the beginning of, not the beginning, from the first sequence on campus in the Raiders of the Lost Ark, when he's standing up giving a lecture about the tomb that he is, we've just seen him running around in. And he stands up and the first words out of his mouth once he's back in the classroom, archaeology is the search for fact, he underlines it, not truth. And he says, if you want truth, Professor So-and-so's philosophy class is down the hall. Ha, ha, ha. Everybody laughs. But I think he's right. I don't really think that what we are dealing with here is these sort of big, broad moral questions. They inform what we do. They are important to what we do. But we can't resolve them. Right? How much empirical research would it take to demonstrate that whether or not abortion was murder? That's not an empirical question. Right? How much empirical research would it take to demonstrate whether or not euthanasia was an appropriate practice? That's also not an empirical question. Now, empirics can give us an awful lot of information that feeds into those debates, but you can't resolve those debates empirically. Now, how fast does an object accelerate in a 1G field when I drop it? That I can give you empirical evidence about. Right? That I can actually come to some resolution of. Because we all agree on the basic parameters of like dropping and gravity and so on and so forth. So we agree on that stuff. We can measure it. We can actually come to consensus about it through empirics. A lot of things when you come to questions of truth, you can't come to consensus about through empirics. So they're there. They inform what we do, but they're not the direct subject of what we're dealing with. So in a sense, the kind of true that empirical research can deal with is just about statements, right? We can say that a particular claim is true or not. But all that means when we're dealing with empirical research is that it corresponds to the facts. It doesn't mean that it's somehow morally or transcendentally justified. Right? And I make this claim because, to belabor this point a little bit, precisely because, A, we're sort of trespassing into that kind of territory to begin with, but also because When we are dealing with sort of contentious political issues in particular, right, ethnic mobilization, human rights violations, genocide, things like this, we often find ourselves in situations as social researchers where our own motivation for something has to do with the fact that we think someone has made a claim that is just morally unacceptable. And that's great. That gets you fired up. That gets you into the situation. It does not, however, it does not substitute for a piece of careful empirical evidence. And it is not the same thing. Something can be perfectly empirically sound and morally unacceptable. Right? These two things do not necessarily go together. It is entirely possible to have a sort of empirically consistent account of, you know, brutal practices without morally thinking those practices are good. Right? It is possible to do this. People do it all the time. There is a marvelous book by Christopher Browning called Ordinary Men, which is a book about a police battalion in the Second World War, which was assigned, it was one of the special police battalions that was assigned to the Eastern Occupied Territories during the Second World War. Now, if you know anything about the history of the Second World War, you probably already have a pretty good sense of what the special police battalions were doing during the Second World War when they were assigned to the East. They were going around and systematically exterminating various Jews that they found, rounding them up and shooting them. It is possible to have incredibly sound empirical research about that without saying that you are morally sanctioning what those practices are, right? These two are different kinds of things. Moral condemnation of a practice is different than an empirical analysis of how it actually works. And that's the reason I belabor this, to make sure that when we get into something, when you get into something that sort of that you're very impassioned about, make sure you separate that out. Your moral judgment of it versus your empirical research on it. These are not necessarily the same operation, and it's important to keep them that way. This is Weber when he was a little older. And I bring him back because one of Weber's other essays, a very famous essay, is this essay called Science as a Vocation, in which Weber actually argues that when we are engaged in, of course he was German, so when he talked about science he used the word Wissenschaft, but the word Wissenschaft actually means something a little broader than the English word science. Wissenschaft actually means something like systematic empirical inquiry. It actually picks up the Latin root of the English word science, scientia, systematic knowledge, but the English word science has become much narrower, right? If I say science, you probably think of white lab coats, right? Somebody with test tubes, Beaker from the Muppets, right? You sort of think of something, there's a particular set of imagery that's associated with science. Weber, however, argued that what we do in the social sciences can be just as wissenschaftlich, just as scientific, as long as he argued, one must be devoted only to the matter at hand, i.e. not making moral judgments on it, but simply exploring how it is that various empirical things are put together. Now, that's not different than what happens in art, because in art people do the same thing. You subordinate yourself to what it is that you're dealing with, and then you kind of step back from it after that. So Weber said, this is what we have to do, right? What we have to do is we have to look at things, and we have to make sure that we get as empirically accurate a picture of them as we can. Right? That's the goal of how you sort of do social science.
How do you separate morality from interpreting the facts?
Good question. And it just so happens that Weber had a little bit of an answer to that, which I will offer. Weber's answer to how do you separate these moral questions from the empirical questions was what he called value neutrality. Now, this has often been misunderstood. People look at a phrase like value neutrality and they think it means that research doesn't have any values. Weber actually argued the opposite. Value neutrality means all research has values, but values are not sufficient to decide a research question. So your values inform what it is that you're doing, but they get you to a certain point. And then after that point, what takes over is research methodology. And then you can say, all right, we're going to have an empirical discussion about this, and regardless of how this empirical discussion plays out, I still have my moral commitment here, which is that that form of government is just inherently unjust. But I can think it's just, you can think it's unjust, we can still agree on how it works. We can still agree empirically on how particular sorts of things are done, and then we step back and I can say, isn't that just genius? And you can say, no, that's horrible. It's a violation of this, that, and the other thing. Okay, great. Moral questions, we are still both coming at it from our own points of view. But what we've done is by keeping that sort of out in the next room, as it were, we've been able to come to some empirical consensus. Right? So that's the procedure that Weber had in mind. His suggestion was that good research, like good teaching, is supposed to be value neutral. good teaching is important to this. Weber actually argued at one point that the easiest way to fool a group of students and to get them on your side in terms of your perspective is never to present your perspective. Instead, you stand up at the front of the room and you just present the facts. Because if you just stand up at the front of the room and present the facts, or if you do it in a, what's that phrase Bill O'Reilly likes? No spin zone. You go ahead and you present the facts. And of course, what you've done is you've imported a perspective right along with them. You just haven't called anybody's attention to the fact that you've imported a perspective. You've just said, oh, here's the facts. And if people don't know anything about it, they go, yeah, okay, well, that makes sense. Whereas the first question we should always be asking is, from what point of view? From what perspective? In what context? How are you going from empirical observation to that set of facts? Right? Because otherwise, there's a perspective that's kind of being smuggled along with that, and one needs to be kind of careful for these things. What this means for Weber, as I've been saying, is that it means that empirical research can't actually solve value questions, so we shouldn't actually try to do research on whether or not something is morally justified. We should instead do research on how moral justifications work, or whether or not a certain course of action that has been proposed to address a moral problem is going to be likely to solve it, abstracting for a moment from the question of whether or not it actually is a moral problem, right? So it sort of constrains the domain of what we can actually ask and answer when we're doing empirical research. So what this means in the end is that methodologies are grounded in values. We start with our values, but their application is not. Weber had this, and it is unfortunately a slightly non-PC comment. Remember, he was writing in 1905, in which he argued that our empirical research should be good enough that even a Chinese would be able to appreciate its validity. And why did Weber say that? Because the furthest thing he could imagine from his own bourgeois Western existence was a Chinese person. Totally different sets of values. He's not actually referring to an empirical Chinese person. The point is, someone who has an entirely different set of value orientation should be able to look at my research or look at your research and say, you know, I don't agree with where this guy's coming from, but the claims they're making make sense. The insights that they're generating are useful. They're consistently applying their sets of techniques. And then you can step back from it and say, but I think their whole perspective is morally reprehensible. Okay, cool, but that's a separate question. I often find myself doing this with particular research perspectives that I think are kind of morally abhorrent, but people use them, and I say, okay, well, you know, let's see what happens if you apply that. Did you do it right? Did you apply it well? Can we sort of agree on the sorts of insights that you generate? All right, great. And then we can have the argument later about whether or not what you've done is sort of value acceptable. Empirical research is supposed to be, the application of these empirical techniques is not itself just a set of value orientations. What this also means, and this is very important in terms of international relations, in terms of IR research, particularly at SIS, there is a difference between doing empirical research and conducting a normative analysis of something. Because conducting a normative analysis of something, which is what one often does within, say, you know, human rights work, which is, you know, this is very, very useful stuff, it isn't empirical research. Because it is more about, here are sets of moral commitments, and I'm going to illustrate those moral commitments by giving you some examples. That's a marvelous exercise. In Weber's point of view, that's not social science anymore. What that is politics. And of course, if you say that to someone who practices that kind of human rights analysis, then they would say, well, of course it is. The whole reason I'm doing this is to demonstrate that so-and-so's set of policies is morally unacceptable and therefore should be changed. Sure, great, go ye forth and do that. That's not what we're doing here. That's not empirical research, that's something else. It is perfectly legitimate, valid, and important in its own way, but it's not the kind of thing that we're actually sort of looking at with this.
Mm-hmm. Looking in the world and saying, okay, like this here is violating that there.
Mm-hmm. If it, just to repeat for the sake of the podcast, if we have someone who is doing research saying, here are sets of claims and I'm going to look into the world and see to what extent something actually counts as a violation. Right. So if I'm going ahead and doing that, think about what I'm actually doing there. What I'm doing is I'm saying, here are sets of value orientations, which the presumption is the reader agrees with. And now I'm going to take those and I'm going to go out into the world and show you. It's what Amnesty does when they do their annual report, right? Amnesty's report shows where violations are occurring and how much of them. There's a lot of information in that document. It is converted into a certain set of, shall we say, politically relevant facts. Because what is that Amnesty report designed to do? It's designed to annoy people, shame governments, spark letter writing campaigns, etc., etc. It is for a very particular purpose. That purpose is not systematically constructing knowledge that would meet social scientific standards. That's not what it's designed to do. And that's not a knock on Amnesty. It would actually bother me if that's what Amnesty was trying to do. And say, well, if you really want to actually improve human rights in the world, don't do social science about it. If you actually want to improve human rights in the world, go do a human rights campaign. That's what you should be doing. Empirical research isn't about that. Empirical research is about generating systematic knowledge of the world, which could then perhaps be plugged into something. For instance, say Amnesty's document is one of the recommendations that comes out of it is a letter writing campaign. Well, that would suggest a very interesting social scientific question. Do letter writing campaigns change governmental policy? That's an interesting question. How would we study that? Well, now we end up having a set of research methodologies that would tell us how we might evaluate that proposition. And then the result of that investigation, we could go back to Amnesty and give that to them and say, you know what? Letter writing campaigns are actually less effective than this other mode of influence, for instance, if that was the finding that we happen to have. And then we offer that back to Amnesty, and Amnesty says, oh, cool, great. Doesn't affect what they did in their report at all. Because their report wasn't about generating systematic empirical knowledge. Their report was about producing a political document designed to affect change. So these are two different kinds of things. Social science can inform change in the world, but at one step removed, right? It's not direct, it's sort of indirect. We research techniques, we then give the techniques to the people who are actually going to be involved in making the change. Even that may be yourself, right? You may do that yourself. You sort of transmit it from like one side of your brain to the other. Here's my social science, I did my social science work. Now I'm going to take off my social science hat, and I'm going to go downtown and actually organize. Great, I'm going to take the results, what I had from my social science side, and I'm going to go put those into practice. My whole point is those are two different operations, and they need to be kept at least conceptually separate. Because otherwise, they start kind of infecting one another. You end up with a situation where you make methodological compromises for political expediency, and that works really well if you're in politics, and not so well if you're actually trying to conduct social science. So that's the claim I'm trying to make here. All right. I've mentioned these terms, methods and methodologies, a little bit. I should probably expand a little bit on what it is that I mean by these things. This is a distinction that I think is very helpful, but it is a distinction that is not often remarked upon within, oh, almost anything that writes about this stuff. People conflate method and methodology all the time. And I think these are that conflation is responsible, actually, for a lot of problems. See, a method is just a technique for gathering information. When you turn to one another before, and I asked you to introduce each other, I gave you a method. I said, talk to each other and find out things so you can introduce each other. Right? I didn't say, have each other write things down. I didn't say, Google each other and find out what you get from profiles. Look each other up on Facebook and see what you can find that way. That's not what I said. I gave you a particular kind of method direction, which was, here's the technique I want you to use to gather information. You know, interviewing, archival work, right? I'm in archives reading stuff. That's a way of gathering information. Now, all these are just techniques. Now, methodology is more than just a technique. A methodology is actually more of a philosophical rationale for why you would use a particular technique to answer a particular question. Why would it be appropriate to ask someone versus try to find something out indirectly? Why would it be appropriate to take evidence that I've gotten from them and put it into a story versus taking that evidence and coding it and putting it into a large database? Those are methodological questions. Right? What do I do with this evidence that I've been able to gather? How do I analyze the data once I have it? That's where methodology really takes over, is this question of what you do with this stuff. Why use particular techniques? Comparative case study is a methodology. It is not a method. It is not a technique. It is a way of organizing and framing your research. It tells you, it answers the question, what do I do with all this information that I have about these different cases? Well, comparative case study methodology explains what you do when you start putting these things together. Same with something like relational discourse analysis. I have a bunch of public statements. What do I do with them? Well, now what I do with them if I'm doing discourse analysis is I sort of look through them for various kinds of themes. I isolate commonplaces. I look for tropes and gestures. I mean, those kinds of things. Those are methodological questions. How do I analyze this stuff once I've got it? These two are not actually the same. Let me give you a sort of quasi-cutesy illustration of why these two are not the same. This, of course, is actually not a real iceberg. This is a very famous internet fake photo of an iceberg, but it illustrates the point very nicely, which is that if you have an iceberg, as people on the Titanic know very well, approximately 10% of it is above the water. Approximately 90% of it is below the water. People like to talk about method as if it were just this sort of freestanding thing, as if you could just go out and like, oh, just interview people, right? Oh, you know, just go read some stuff. Just go do some archival work. As if somehow that made sense. But again, as the people on the Titanic realized, if you just think that that's the whole iceberg, you're going to run into problems because there's all this other stuff floating around underneath the water. And in particular, these things like ontology and epistemology, theories about being, theories about knowing, which I'll elaborate on in just a second, that's all floating around down there underneath the water and holding up those methods. The thing that actually links them together is this thing called methodology. So in a sense, what we're going to do here is we're going to dip down below the surface a little bit. We're not going to spend much of our time, or too much of our time, up there on the top. We're going to spend most of our time down here in this sort of middle range talking about methodology. It's not a philosophy of science class, so we're not really going to spend a lot of time down here in the epistemology ontology level. We will talk about those things occasionally, but we will spend most of our time thinking about how do these things frame the world, what kind of perspective do they actually give us, that's kind of what we're actually after in these things. So talking simply about techniques as if they didn't have all this stuff behind them is actually a fairly dangerous thing to do. That doesn't stop people from doing it all the time. You end up with, well, if we go back to sort of coverage of politics, people utilize the method of opinion polling and don't really talk much about exactly what's going on. You know, when they say, oh, let's consult the exit polls. Have you ever seen a good discussion on sort of popular news media about exactly what an exit poll is and how reliable an exit poll might be and what kinds of questions they're asking and how you actually do? Because if you actually watch people conducting exit polls, it's really funny. They sit there and they're sort of, you know, randomly selecting people, but often the random selection process isn't all that random. And you end up with all manner of interesting sort of puzzles. And even if they were conducting it absolutely correctly, it's still an open question whether or not asking people who've just voted their opinion about various things is a particularly reliable way of finding anything out. There's a whole series of methodological questions that are going on in here. And you never hear about that stuff because it doesn't make for good ad copy. What makes for good copy is methods. Well, we called some people and within plus or minus 3 percentage points, we know the following sets of things. Okay, great, but you didn't give me enough information to actually evaluate your claim, right? So one of the sort of others that I've set up here is kind of straight up activism, which is a different thing. I also want to differentiate what we do in terms of social science from what a lot of journalists do, which is gathering some pieces of information and then reporting them. That's not what we're doing. We're in the business of producing them. We're in the business of producing them systematically. So that's our job.
Is there a difference between
methodology and paradigm? I'm going to punt that question for just a second. On the question, difference between methodology and paradigm, that's a much longer discussion involving, it involves some philosophers of science that I'm not going to get to today, but it is a question that we will come back to. So just hold that one for a second. All right, so I said I would explain my quotation marks. I said I would explain to you why I'm skeptical of this category called qualitative methods. You could probably think about why I'm skeptical of this because of the last slide, right? Grouping methods together by their non-use of numbers is silly. The fact that we have a bunch of different research techniques here that all just don't happen to use numbers, I mean, that's the iceberg problem par excellence. We're just talking about techniques. You know, it's almost an aesthetic question. Right? Why? So here's a set of research techniques that are just prettier because they use words. You know, or people would say, oh, these are prettier because they use numbers. Again, that's kind of silly. I don't really think that's a meaningful conceptual division. It is a sociologically relevant division because people use it all the time. As you can see, we have a class called qualitative methods. So clearly somebody thought it was a good idea. And you always hear people sort of debating about this strange thing called the qualitative-quantitative divide as if this was somehow meaningful. I don't know that it necessarily is at all, because I don't think that the question of whether you use numbers or not has any relevance except for this kind of technical question of whether or not you've got lots of cases or a small number of cases. That's not methodologically all that interesting. That's kind of an empirical question. So I think that, in fact, every informal, non-quantitative mode of research that we're going to be talking about this semester actually has a formal numerical version of it. There are ways of everything we're going to talk about without using numbers during the course of the semester. There are people who do the same thing with numbers. The reason I'm not giving you the with numbers versions is because it gets kind of confusing and because there's some, let's face it, the math that gets used in regular large N statistics, at least at the level most of us are operating right now, is pretty rudimentary math. Not the case when you start getting into things like computational hermeneutics. You have to know how to program in a language called Lisp, which is about it's a recursive programming language that allows you to start producing grammatical rules to characterize sets of statement structures. It's fascinating stuff, but I don't have time to teach you Lisp, and you don't have time to learn it. And so I'm not going to give you the formalized version of that because you would need other kinds of techniques for doing this stuff. So instead, we're going to talk about it all without numbers, but that's largely a time convenience. There's nothing inherent about that. So I don't think the category is particularly all that meaningful. Largely because also the differences between the things that we're doing here, we have these three different kinds of approaches that I'm going to be talking about, the differences are actually considerably more important than the fact that they don't use numbers. Right? Comparative case study work and discourse analysis have entirely different notions of what it means to be causal, entirely different notions of what it means to have sufficient evidence. They ask and answer different kinds of questions. I mean, these are really very, very disparate approaches. Lumping them all together produces a somewhat dizzying experience where you sort of go back and forth between them. And in fact, part of the reason why I do the course the way I do it is because almost every textbook that exists on this stuff just jumps back and forth between these things. And suddenly you'll be in comparative case study land, and then all of a sudden they're doing a little bit of ethnography, and then they're back doing comparative case studies, and then, hey, some discourse analysis. And it's like, wait, you didn't actually spell out the logic of each of these things individually. And so what I'm going to do, what we're going to do in this class, is we're going to approach each of these things individually and only at the end talk about possibilities for either putting them together or not putting them together and allowing them to kind of duke it out. So there'll be a number of different things we'll do there. So avoid synthesis until we get through the things as individual stuff. Let me give you a real quick baseball example of managing as methodology about this difference between methods and methodology in case it sort of wasn't clear enough. Also because I like putting up pictures of baseball because I can talk about, you know, I could talk about the Yankees, and I enjoy talking about the Yankees. But for, you know, if you happen to be managing a baseball team, which I'm assuming none of you are right now, because if you were, you wouldn't be in this class. You'd have people who would go to the class for you. So if you're managing a baseball team, there's a built-in methodology, right? There's a built-in methodology because there's a built-in set of context. There's a built-in set of goals. If you're managing a baseball team, you have one goal. Your goal is to win games. This works the same way within any other sport. If you are managing a sports team, your job is to win. If you don't, you tend to get fired. So it's pretty clear, right? There's not a lot of methodological controversy within professional sports. It's like you're supposed to win. What there is controversy about tactics, about procedures, about strategies, about how best to achieve that particular goal. So there's different tactics that are available in pursuit of the basic goal, which is winning games. And I'll give you an example of this as a sort of debate within baseball at the moment, if you don't know who these two gentlemen are. The gentleman on the left is a gentleman named Roger Clemens. He's been in the news a little bit lately for reasons having nothing to do with baseball and everything having to do with country music singers and karaoke bars. And steroids, don't forget those. The gentleman standing next to him is a gentleman named Andy Pettit, good friend of his, another pitcher who had some illegal drug use issues. Both of them used to be on the New York Yankees, used to play for the Yankees, and as you can see from the, well, maybe you can't, depending on the resolution of it, the uniforms they're wearing there are not Yankees uniforms. Those are uniforms of another team called the Houston Astros. And what happened in the course of this was the management of the Yankees took a look at Andy Pettit's record over a number of years, and they engage in a quantitative analysis of what he had done. In baseball, this is sometimes called sabermetrics, right? You gather a lot of very systematic empirical data numerically about how people are doing. A lot of sports have these kind of things. It's more elaborate in baseball because baseball has the unique thing of having 162 games over the course of the season, so you actually have enough instances of things going on that like the numbers are meaningful. It always amazes me when people go like play fantasy football. It's like you have 12 games. No numbers you have are anything other than luck. How can this mean anything? Baseball, you got 162 games. You have enough repeated experiments that the numbers actually start meaning something after a while. And if you went and looked at sort of Andy Pettit's record, you say, yeah, you know, he's kind of fallen down a little bit and he's not doing as well. And so you calculate how much he's worth. And you say, you know, we don't need to renew him. We'll let him go. And then he goes and signs with another baseball team. Now, the failure that the Yankees management had was not a methodology, it was a method question. They were so enamored of looking at his record that they forgot about sort of the qualitative, more experience and informal kind of management stuff. See, Andy Pettit and Roger Clemens were really good friends. After Andy Pettit was released because he wasn't performing up to snuff, Roger Clemens, who had retired, decided, you know, I think it was really crappy what they did to my friend. I'm going to come back out of retirement. And I'm going to go join the same team as my friend was on so I can go play for my friend's team. And he did. And everybody in the Yankees management was going, oh, God, how could we have missed that? Well, it's because you were so enamored of your one kind of technique that you didn't see there was another kind of technique, qualitative examination of how people's personal relationships are. Look at that. Now, both of those are within the same methodology, same goal, win games. That never changed. These are just different techniques at trying to get at the same kind of outcome. This is a method question we're talking about here. And it's important to realize that this debate about whether you use numbers or not when you're managing your sports team is a method question, because there are also methodology questions that are related to sports, right? Qualitative and quantitative are the same goal if you're a manager, but there's other things that you can do than try to manage a baseball team to the point of winning games. There are other ways of approaching something like baseball, and I use baseball very particularly because baseball is very tightly interwoven into American self-narratives of nationhood. There's a way in which, if you've been to a baseball game lately, you know, right? There's all of this sort of patriotic stuff. It's a theater of nationality. It's a way in which the crowd is invited to participate, particularly here. If you go down to the new Nationals Park, which is beautiful, and they have these $5 day of game sales things. It's fantastic. $5, you get to go sit up in section 402, which is one of the nice sections of the stadium. Really good. It's a nice hot dog stand behind you. Whole experience right there for like, you know, metro fare and $15, $20, right? And you have a good night. And occasionally other good teams come to town so you can see some good baseball. Give the Nats some time, but what was the point I was making? Oh, yes. And so if I do that, if I'm down there and we're at a baseball game, and if this course were organized a little bit differently, I would take you down there so you could see this. Watch a baseball game with the eyes of an ethnographer. Look at social meaning. Look at the ways in which notions of the nation are produced and reproduced for the fans, right? Pledge of Allegiance, the various kinds of rituals about honoring the military, God Bless America being sung. There's a whole number of things that are sort of set up to create a sense of belonging to some, what Benedict Anderson would call the imagined community of America. So this is a ritual that's being enacted here. Now, if I analyze baseball that way, that's a methodological question. Because now I'm no longer interested in winning games. Now I'm interested in talking about the social function of baseball within the American psyche. So I'm doing something different. That's a methodology question. Right? Whether I use numbers or not if I'm managing the team is a method question. Whether I'm interested in managing the team or whether I'm interested in doing a broader analysis of the sport's role in society, that is a question of methodology. And the reason that's a methodology question is because the game appears very differently from different methodological standpoints. Do not try to manage a baseball team with a firm grasp on the importance of baseball to the American psyche and a not-so-firm grasp on how a double switch works. That's not going to get you very far. You have to know these technical things in order to manage the team. But the point is that different methodologies are going to make, in a sense, different sense, different facts out of the same empirical thing, which is baseball. All right, it's going to be different perspectives that come out of this. Yes?
So to tie in his questions earlier about paradigm shift.
Mm-hmm. I may have to.
I'm thinking of like George Steinbrenner, an anti-Yankees fan.
Okay.
I think George
Steinbrenner brought about a paradigm shift in the way that baseball was played in America.
Okay.
He was willing to spend, he could and was willing to spend a ton of money for really key players.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that would be an example of where his methodology would be the same, his methods would be the same. But the paradigm shift of how you do play baseball in America,
I think you're justice to the metaphor. But let me respond sort of from inside the metaphor. George Steinbrenner, people who don't obsessively follow baseball, George Steinbrenner is the person who's owned the New York Yankees for years and years and years, and is often understood to be this person who affected all sorts of change in the way baseball was played, not on the field so much, but because he has bajillions of dollars, and he uses these to go out and buy really, really high-priced talent from other teams. And so there's a lot of financial inequity within baseball. There are teams that make very little, like the Nationals, the formerly known as the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, but now they're just the Tampa Bay Rays, and actually good this year, so which is interesting. But what Steinbrenner is usually understood to have done is to change the whole game of baseball because of the amount of money he was throwing around. So there's a question of whether this is a sort of paradigm shift. I would say two things, one of which is a sort of really geeky inside baseball response, and one of which is the one that's more appropriate for the class. But I have to make the really geeky inside baseball response first, which is there's this marvelous, marvelous book called Taking on the Yankees, which is a book about the history of baseball ownership and baseball management. And it demonstrates that nothing that Steinbrenner was doing was not something that owners had not been doing for 100 years before. The only difference is Steinbrenner was louder and more vocal about it. But this has always been the case, that rich owners were going out and buying high-priced talent. And so in that sense, it's not even really that much of a shift. It's sort of an expansion of something that was in fact already there. How does this relate back to what we're talking about here? The goal of someone like Steinbrenner was still exactly the same, which was win baseball games. The methods are a little bit different because there's more cash being tossed around. Where you could argue that he was affecting a change was in shifting baseball from just a sport to a media event. And actually arguing, okay, the real point of baseball isn't actually to win games. The real point of baseball is to sell tickets and get lots of money and have people pay lots of money for the local entertainment and sports network, which is where massive amounts of cash it comes in to these things. So Steinbrenner changes not necessarily baseball, but he shifts the sort of infrastructure around it in various ways. I would argue that that's not even a paradigm shift. I think that's a methodology question. So to the extent that he was making a methodology shift, he sort of shifted baseball so that it appears now not just as an on-the-field competition, but as an entertainment, sort of a particular kind of entertainment. There's all sorts of reasons why we sort of go into that. But again, it's not a class on baseball, so I'm not going to bore everybody else. But I think that really what he affected was that kind, or is starting to affect that kind of a methodology shift. I still don't think it affects the question of management, because I think managers still have the same goal in mind, which is win the game on the field. So I think that part of it still actually holds up. And parenthetically, even Yankees fans are not all that crazy about Steinbrenner sometimes. So it's not just the anti-Yankee fans. All right, but I have this other example here of methodology distinction, which I'm just going to go through really quickly, which is sort of, if you think about a classroom as being a situation in which there are different kinds of methodologies, different contextual organizings of how a classroom would work. If you take a professor and a set of students, and you put them in a situation where, as is right now, you're all sitting there and I'm sort of beaming information at you, right, with these nice red arrows shooting information at you, right? Think of that as a particular kind of methodology, a particular context, a particular way in which this association of us is organized, right? And we would ordinarily call this a sort of a presentation. Now, there are method questions about how to do a good presentation. Should I use slides? Should I not use slides? Should we have a break? Should we not have a break? Should I pretend to be soliciting answers from you and actually sit and listen and wait for the answer that I want and then say, ah, good point, and then go on and make the next point I was going to make anyway and pretend I was being interactive? Or should I just eliminate that pretense and just stand up here and talk until I run out of the ability to speak, or until we run out of time. Those are method questions. Those are technical questions. Now, take those same people and let's do a methodological shift. if we actually put them in a situation where the relations are different and information is not flowing unidirectionally, but information becomes bidirectional, and as a network theorist would tell you, we now have a complete network because we have ties between, all possible ties actually exist, right? This is an idealized dream seminar situation or a discussion. And I see if it's undergrads at this point, I would find whoever's cell phone it is and I glare at them. Or occasionally I've walked over and answered the cell phone. They love that. Hi, no, I can't talk to you in class. Click. And that's usually followed by me immediately going, did I remember to turn off my ringer? Huh. And once I was caught, once my own ringer went off right after I did one of those, and I was like, okay, fine. I've lost all credibility. Regardless, if we are talking about this kind of situation right here, right, this is a different kind of methodological organization, different context. There is a way to, it said I wasn't going to talk much about paradigm, but I'll go back to paradigm for just a second. Some people use the word paradigm interchangeably with what I'm calling methodology. The reason I want to use the word methodology is because I want to save the word paradigm for something about substance. So if we talk about a paradigm, we're talking about a set of substantive assumptions about some area rather than about a kind of an approach to the production of knowledge. So we can talk about certain kinds of paradigmatic assumptions that we make about war and peace, for instance. So I want to save those words for meaning something a little bit different. When I talk about this, I want to talk about methodology. Because I think that we have these different classroom methodologies, and if we're ever in a discussion, you know there's different techniques that can be utilized within discussion. There's the volunteering of people to make them talk. There's the small group out-reporting. There's a number of other ways you can sort of get a discussion going. But again, those are technical questions. Those technical questions make no sense if we're in the presentation methodology. Likewise, the things that go on in a presentation methodology, the method questions, don't make any sense over here. Right? This situation, like the baseball situation, I think closely mirrors what we are doing when we are engaged in these sorts of empirical research. We have different methodologies, and we have technical questions within each one of them. But the technical debates within each one of them don't make much sense in other contexts. So step one is to get the context right. Then we can start sort of worrying about the particular kinds of logistical details, which is why what we're going to end up doing this semester is we're going to start with the methodology, and then move to the implementation of things within that particular methodology. That's what happens in each of those three-week sequences, right? We start with me talking a little bit about the methodology, we move to a discussion of an exemplary work within it, and then we have a chance to do it a little bit ourselves. So that's going to be the directionality of each of those points within the class. Now, I mentioned that the things that exist under that iceberg are things called ontology and epistemology. Just real briefly, in case you've forgotten your philosophy, ontology is stuff concerning being, you know, what it means to exist in the world. There are, in general, two different kinds of ontological assumption that I want to work with in this semester. One of them, one kind of ontology is what you might call a scientific ontology, which is a list of stuff that's out there in the world and, you know, what it is, what it means to say that, like, there are states in the world. Or what it means to say that there are norms, right? Those are objects that the IR researchers often point to and say those are things that are out there in the world. That's part of what you might call the scientific ontology of some particular theory. Now, there's also what we might call philosophical ontology, and philosophical ontology is more about how you, the researcher, are plugged into the world, the relationship between the observer and the observed. Right? This sort of sets the standards for anything you would do with those objects that are supposed to exist over there. What objects exist in the world is a matter for substantive theory, not so much for methodology. When we talk in this class about ontology, I'm talking about philosophical ontology, how we observers are plugged into the world, how we relate to the world. Not exactly what's in the world, but how we relate to it, how we are connected to it, how we generate sort of our basic knowledge of it. All right, so that's the first thing I want to work with is this. When I say ontology, I mean these philosophical questions. You all have scientific ontologies because you all have substantive experience and substantive expertise in particular areas. So you all have a catalog of things that you work with. But the methodological question is about sort of how you connect to those objects. Another way of sort of approaching this is to use what you might call the three objectives. If we think about these kinds of ontological or philosophical ontological positions, if we were really subjectivists, then we would say that reality depended completely on our own thoughts and experiences, and that was it. and we're all sort of individually, solipsistically, the only things that actually exist in the world. If that were the case, well, and you know, I'm not going to take any position on whether or not it is the case, but if it is the case, then there wouldn't be any point in doing empirical research, and there wouldn't really be any way you could do it meaningfully. So we're just going to assume for the rest of the semester that it is not in fact the case, that the rest of the world doesn't exist, and it's all just a figment of my imagination. Because, of course, if I'm the one speaking, it would all be me, not you. You wouldn't actually exist. You'd just be figments of me. We're just not going to go there. So we're not actually going to, we're just not going to sort of deal with that. Instead, we're going to talk about two other kinds of bejectives. There is the notion that reality exists independently, objectively outside of the observer. So it's out there someplace. Mind and world are separate. That's one kind of philosophical ontology that we will work with this semester. And another kind is what we might call intersubjective, which is where the observer does not separate from the world, but the observer participates in the production of the world. They're wrapped up with it in various ways. That there's less of a distance between the subject and the object. And those are two different kinds of ontological positions that help to frame modes of research. So the ob and the inter, if you will. Ontology that posits objectivity, I'll also refer to sometimes as dualism. Those of you that are schooled in the philosophical tradition will recognize that term. The idea that, again, there's a mind and the world, knowledge and the world, these are two separate kinds of things, so it's dualistic. I'll also sometimes talk about intersubjectivity as being monistic, which is to say that there's not really a separation between knowledge and the world, but they're kind of continuous and bleed into each other in different ways. You can think about this in terms of the difference between researching from a distance and researching from really close up. If you're researching from really close up, you often do that because you think that the kind of knowledge that you have depends on how you interact with the world. Versus if you do it from far away, the assumption you're often making is the world's out there anyway, and so I want to try not to mess it up. I want to try to stand back and get as clear a view of it as I can. Right? So that's the sort of basic difference between dualism and monism. On the other side of that little leg underneath the iceberg, we had epistemology, which is all about the truth of statements and knowledge. Now, epistemology isn't just this, though. It also kind of picks up sort of issues about what we can know about, what it means to have knowledge of particular kinds of things, how confident we can be in our knowledge, what it means to have sure knowledge or secure knowledge. Right, those are kind of epistemological concerns. Now, we could go for a very long time on epistemological concerns. And for the sake of this course, I want to focus just on one kind of subset of epistemological concerns. And that's the question of whether we can know anything about causality. Whether we can know anything about what causes something to happen, or whether all we can do is just describe stuff that happens. And that's a very important kind of distinction. I think that's directly relevant to the sort of empirical work that we're all doing, whether or not we think we can, say, simply describe human rights violations, or whether we can explain why certain things that we code as human rights violations actually occur. Those are two different kinds of questions, or two different kinds of approaches, and I think that's ultimately an epistemological issue about whether we can know anything about cause or not. Now, if you take that, you notice what I've done here. I've got two different ontological positions and two different epistemological positions. And if you put them together, you get the social scientist's best friend. The social scientist's best friend is, you guessed it, a 2x2 table. Because if it's not a 2x2 table, it's not social science. So let us talk about what happens if you put these things together. This is going to be our map for how the course is actually going to work. Look at subject-object dualism versus monism, right? So these things are there, but if we sort of say, what if you were, let's talk about just the descriptive ones for a second. Suppose you didn't think we could know things about causation. Suppose you thought the only things we can know about, all we can do is describe things in the world, the state that things actually are. And if you were a dualist and you thought the world was out there and all you could do is describe it, well, it turns out that what you would be actually interested in is doing large N quantitative work. Because in order to really be sure that your description was actually reaching the real world the way it really was, you'd want to gather as much data as possible and sort of make sure that it was systematically interrelated. Right? So that's what you would be wanting to do. If you were, on the other hand, an intersubjective monist and thought that actually you and the world were kind of intermingled and interacted with each other, but you thought your job was basically to describe the sets of social relations that you were embedded in, then you would be doing what we will learn to call interpretive ethnography, aka thinking like an anthropologist, because this is often what a lot of anthropologists do. That is a mode of research in which what we do is we go out into the world and we engage in what's sometimes called participant observation. We're involved in a set of social relations, and then we try to systematically relate what that looks like, to describe it as clearly and cleanly as possible. All right, so that's sort of where the box should be located. Now, if you were instead interested in causal claims, which a lot of people are, but if you still thought the world existed out there and your job was to build the best picture of that world out there that you could, but you're really interested in causation, and you'd read a few things about causation that had been written since, say, Descartes, and you realized that that causation didn't always show up as these confidence ratings that you get with large N statistics, and that in fact there were more subtle ways that causation actually worked in practice, and you really wanted more detailed analysis of how something led to something else, but you still thought there was a world out there that you had to sort of get to knowledge of, well, you'd be doing what's called small N case comparison. Intensive case study work where you're looking at particular cases and then trying to draw limited generalizations across those specific cases, informed by deep contextual knowledge of each of the cases in a way that you can't possibly have if you've got a large N data set. Nobody knows 200 cases or 2,000 cases or 2 million cases in detail. Three you can get, right? So small N comparison, we usually end up with people doing three cases, sort of magic number. And so that would be a way of getting at causation, but still saying there are real relations out there in the world that I have to sort of approximate. Now, what if you actually thought that you were much more monistic about things, and you actually thought that reality, mind and reality, were actually still continuous with each other, but you still wanted to talk about causation? You'd be engaged in configurational analysis, which is our last kind of methodology. Configurational analysis, network theory, discourse analysis, these are the things we'll be talking about during the third kind of unit in the class. So that is basically the sum total of what we're going to be doing, except since it's a qualitative quote-unquote research methodology course, we're actually not going to be talking about that one. And we're not going to talk about that one because, well, we have whole classes in that. And so you've already done that, or you're going to already do that at some point. And we don't have enough time in the semester. So instead, we're going to talk about these three. This is the map. This is what we're actually going to be discussing during the course of the semester, is going to be these approaches. And this is where they all fit and how they actually relate to one another. Now, it occurs to me that it is 7:55. And it also occurs to me that according to this, I have 5 slides? How could I possibly have 5 slides? Let's see. Is there anything important on these slides? Let's find out. Oh, right. Don't look for answers. A lot of these epistemological and ontological questions that we're going to be wrestling with, they're going to be at the foundation of what we're wrestling with for the next few weeks, are not easily resolvable. And no philosophers actually, philosophy is still debating about this stuff. Theologians are still debating about this stuff. Nobody's figured it out. We're not going to figure it out in the next 7 weeks. We're not going to figure out definitively the answer to how the brain is hooked into the world or whether we can know things about causation. We're not going to be able to do that. We are, however, going to be able to make a provisional assessment of whether and how our positions on these things inform the kind of empirical research that we're actually doing. So don't think about this like a philosopher. This is not a philosophy class. Think about this like a social scientist. Think about this as someone who's actually concerned to be making systematic empirical knowledge. Philosophical concerns inform what we do. That's necessarily the case. But there are no answers there. This helps us clarify our thinking. Ultimately, the test of a good piece of social science is not whether it has a really compelling ontology. The test of a good piece of social science is whether it tells us something interesting about the world. And that's ultimately what we're trying to do here. All of this other stuff is sort of baggage that helps us clarify what it is that we're doing when we set out to make sense out of the world and construct facts about it. In fact, and I'll keep coming back to this during the course of the semester, a lot of the basic questions that underlie this stuff are ultimately these kinds of moral or theological questions. I mean, do we know things about causation? You can only think about that question for about 10 minutes before you start getting into, okay, is there a God? I mean, it leads itself very, very quickly into these like big theological reflections. And if you don't believe me, try reading any of the slightly popularized versions that physicists tell when they try to do this. You know, when Stephen Hawking starts trying to talk about the origin of the universe, it takes him about 5 pages before he starts talking about Augustine and the notion of a being outside of time and so on and so forth. He's like, okay, all right. So it's very, very easy to go into those. And that's fascinating stuff. And it's not what this class is about. So we're going to gesture in that direction. But we're not actually going to, hopefully, spend an awful lot of time in theological discussion. But you never know. It might tip over. We might end up talking about theology for a little while. But for the most part, I want to try to keep us actually focused not so much on those, but on the implication of these different sorts of positions. Now, lest you think that everything is going sort of off in different directions here, realize that there are some constants. There are some constants across all the different things we're going to be looking at tonight. Not tonight. All the different things we're going to be looking at this semester. All good research is what Weber would call wissenschaftlich. It's systematic. There's data involved. All good research has a research question. There's something that you want to know about the world, and you're trying to provide an empirically grounded answer to whatever that thing actually is. So whatever style of research we're talking about here, that is constant across all of them. All good research is trying to answer a question. And is trying to answer a question that the researcher doesn't know the answer to at the outset. If you already know the answer to it at the outset, you are not doing research. You are writing an op-ed, or you are writing a blog post. These are wonderful endeavors. They are not systematic empirical research and should not be conflated with them. Now, when we talk about these research proposals that you're going to be doing, this is just to very quickly reinforce what I said on the syllabus, that a good research proposal has 4 different things attached to it, right? It has that research question. You've got to tell me what your question is. As the semester goes on, you will see the kinds of questions you ask tell us an awful lot about the methodology that you use to answer them. Methodologies and questions go hand in hand with one another. A full research proposal would also have literature summaries and literature critiques. Often we put these things together and we call them a literature review. That's where you sort of look at what other scholars have said and say why they're wrong and set up your own stuff. That's the whole point of a literature review. People sometimes get this wrong. They think a literature review means just summarizing what other people said. That's like half of it. Half of it is summarizing. But then you have to show what's wrong with it. Because if the literature's already solved the question, why the heck are you doing the research? You have to say, no, they did something wrong here. They missed something. Or they've answered this question, but nobody's ever looked at it in Guatemala. Okay, great. Well, then there's a hole in the literature and it's something I'm going to go and fill. Right? There has to be that critical element of it. And in fact, if I had to choose, I would almost say the critical element is more important than the summary. And this is particularly important for if you're writing a thesis or if you're writing a dissertation. It's not always necessary to get everything that's ever been written on your subject into your literature review because you can't. It's just too big. This is a sort of paradox. By the time you actually get everything that's been written on your subject into your literature review, more stuff will have been written about your subject. And then you'll put that in, and then more stuff will have been written about your subject, and it just sort of grows and grows and grows until it consumes you and everybody else around you. So it's more important to have the critique if you're talking about existing scholarship than it is to talk about an accurate summary. It's more important to say what's wrong and set up your own work. That's the thing where you should be sort of going for. The summary can't be completely erroneous, but, and again, this is sort of beside the point because we're not doing literature reviews in this class, but just in general, I'll just kind of toss that out there. The thing that's most important for this class is that number 4, which is the methodological plan, which is that when you are setting up these research proposals or mini research proposals that you're doing, what you're actually doing is you're telling me how you're going to set out to answer the research question. All of this stuff hangs together, right? The question tells you what the appropriate literature is. The critique tells you why the literature hasn't answered the question. The methodology is your better answer to how you're going to get at the answer to the question, right? Your plan. How are you going to answer that question better than other people have? Even though I'm not asking you to do literature reviews in this class, chances are you are already familiar with literature on your particular topic. You probably already know things about why you don't like their answers. You can use that to bounce off of. And when you start thinking about your own answers, because your own answers are supposed to be dialoguing with the answers that other people have already given, right? That's the whole game. That's how research actually works. Now, the details of what the methodological plan especially looks like are going to differ across different methodologies. As the semester goes on, we'll see that's actually a very important way of differentiating methodologies, what kind of questions they can ask, what kinds of questions they can answer. And very quickly, let me just caution you, and I will come back to this several times during the course of the semester. I'm going to caution you against being too quick to say that what we should do with these different methodologies is sort of balance them off against each other, right? That if you're doing a piece of empirical work, you should have a little bit of this, and a little bit of that, and a little bit of something else. This is a very popular position. I use the word not in a political sense, but in more of a political theoretic sense, a very liberal position, right? You have something, you have something, you have something. Hey, let's just put them all together. The problem with that is that these different methodologies we'll be talking about this semester are in many ways incommensurable. Combining them often produces incoherence. You end up with examples of books in which people will flip back and forth between, here's my statistical part, and here's my case study, and then I went and I did some participant observation. And you're left with this book that just doesn't add up to a single book, or an article that doesn't add up to a single article, because how the pieces fit together is not at all easy to determine. So my caution to us at the beginning of this little journey here is that we should not necessarily think that we want to get everything into our projects. What we should do is we should be explicit about our presuppositions, we should be consistent, and we should be somewhat humble about what it is that we're doing here, and not ever claim that because you happen to have a particular perspective on something that the perspective that you have is somehow universally or transcendentally justified. That's a hard claim to substantiate, and so it's part of the reason why I do three different things in this course. We could do an entire course on any one of these three, right? But the other reason I do these things differently in the course is because in the field of the social sciences in general, there's an awful lot of methodological diversity. People do a lot of different kinds of things. And I'm hoping that one of the takeaway things that you can get from this class is a better sense of what that diversity is like. It'll help you decode what some of this other information and other research is that's actually out there. And I would be lax if I did not conclude by pointing out that no one who wasn't a monist would actually have made any of the arguments that I've made tonight. I have a position. My position is in the lower right-hand corner of that box that I showed you. That is where I stand, and I have written many things on this, and it's no secret, and I can be Googled, so it's true. If you Google me, you find that I've written methodological stuff, and the stuff that I've written comes out of a particular kind of perspective. Yes, of course it does. And the kind of pleas for tolerance that I'm giving, you would not necessarily find in, say, someone who was absolutely committed to large-end quantitative analysis because of the methodology of the idea of there being a world that you have to approximate and there being no way that you can actually get past fine-grained description. They would say there's no point in being tolerant of other research methodologies. We just do what we do, and that's how we should do it. The kind of position that I have obviously derives from something that's endogenous to the course. Of course I have a position. You should not assume that what I'm giving you is unbiased. Of course it's biased. Everything's biased. The difference is, I like to think I'm pretty darn explicit about what my biases are. I've just spent an hour and a half belaboring them. You have them. You have them publicly. I have a bit of a distaste for rapid attempts at synthesis. I am not all that much in favor of trying to combine these things without thinking through very, very carefully what their specific differences are. Other people may feel differently about this, but that's the way that I've actually designed this. Always remember that my position on this stuff is contestable. And I'm perfectly happy to have you contest it. You know, ask me questions. Push me on this stuff. It's perfectly fine. Do not necessarily take it. However, the one thing that's not contestable, you still have to write three separate research proposals, and they still have to be in these separate methodologies. You can walk out and say, okay, after 7 weeks, the main thing I learned is that Jackson's full of crap, and that these things can be combined really easily, and this is the way I want to combine them. Cool. If you can walk out with that as a defensible position 7 weeks from now, I will feel like I have done a good job, because you will have a better sense of that. Now, I would be willing to bet you that you can't walk out with that position, but I'm happy to let people try. No. Whatever position you will end up taking, you can count on me to give you an opposite. and try to push you, because my job is not to convince you one way or the other. My job is to help you articulate the best position that you can articulate. Right? This is not a class about my research. It's not a class about my research methodology. It's a class about your research, and this is a class about how different research methodologies can help you to do your work. And that's the spirit in which you should treat this. So. Now,